This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Thomas Ricks, covers the military for The Washington Post. Last week, he returned from Iraq after having spent most of May covering the emerging shape of the occupation. He was what he describes as loosely embedded with the 1st Armored Division, the replacement force for the 3rd Infantry Division, the unit that took Baghdad in early April. In addition to spending time with the division and getting briefings at headquarters, he broke away from the military to investigate stories on his own. Tom Ricks has covered military activities in Somalia, Korea, Bosnia, Kuwait, the Persian Gulf, and Afghanistan. He wrote about the military for the Wall Street Journal before joining the Washington Post. He was part of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams of reporters covering military preparations for the 21st century and the war on terrorism. Members of the intelligence community have said that the Bush administration pressured them into cooking information and that the Bush administration cherry-picked information to support its case for war against Iraq. The same thing is happening to the Blair administration in England. Do you have any insights into that issue from covering the military or from having recently been in Iraq?
Yeah, having knocked around Iraq recently, and especially having visited a couple of the two places in Baghdad that were specifically bombed in order to kill Saddam Hussein, one thing that really struck me is that the U.S. intelligence community appears to have vastly, I think, overestimated Saddam Hussein's capabilities. And while most of the intelligence discussion has been about his weapons of mass destruction capabilities, I was out looking for tunnels and bunkers, which we kept on being told were built across underground Baghdad, that there are all sorts of escape tunnels and bunkers. Yes, there are some bunkers, but they're pretty noticeable. I mean, they're visible. There's one right near the hotel I was staying at. But when I went out to Dora Farms and to the Al-Saw restaurant, the two places that were bombed in order to kill Saddam Hussein, and at neither place was there any evidence of tunnels or bunkers. And locals I talked to at both places said, look, we've lived here for years. We would have seen tunnels being built. There would have been some evidence of that. You would have seen workers. I talked to a farmer at the Dora Farm site who said, look, I've been out here turning the soil every day for 20 years, and I've never seen any evidence of tunnels or bunkers.
So what does that say to you about U.S. intelligence, about what the Pentagon said about his bunkers?
It seems in retrospect that they may have taken counsel of their fears. Also, that evidence that supported the administration's view probably was given far more credence and weight than evidence that disputed the administration's views. And in retrospect, I think there probably was a real problem with the intelligence that it got skewed. It toward supporting the administration's arguments rather than a kind of neutral sifting of the facts.
Do you think that it's possible that Saddam Hussein wasn't quite as powerful as the Bush administration built him up to be?
Yes and no. In terms of weapons of mass destruction, obviously yes. I mean, from the Iraqi government's own admissions, at some point he did possess weapons of mass destruction. In fact, he used weapons of mass destruction, chemical weapons, on people many times. He had VX nerve gas. He was interested in having nuclear capabilities. So he had possession. He had intent. The only question then is, did he still have it? And he may have very well have tried to get rid of it in order to get the U.S. to stop bothering him. I think ultimately they probably will find some chemical or biological weapons. If you go hunting in Northwest D.C., where I live, you will find old mustard gas canisters left over from World War I. Similarly, probably across Iraq, there's old buried stuff that people either forgot about or hid, or the guy who hid it for the Iraqi military was killed subsequently. For example, I was told at the end of the Gulf War in 1991 that they took out some weapons, nerve gas and chemicals, and buried them in sections of highway and then repaved the highway. Now, that stuff is probably still there, and ultimately it probably will be found. And that will be put out by the Bush administration as supporting its case. The response will come back from the doubters that, well, this was old stuff, maybe even inert, if it was old biological weapons, maybe even fallen apart and chemically decomposed if it were chemical weapons. And that he was not going to use it. And I think we'll probably never really resolve it in one way or the other way. Some stuff will be found, but it will not go to the... It won't dispositively answer the issue of whether he intended to use it in this period now.
We were talking for a couple of minutes before the interview started, and you compared Saddam Hussein to Tony Soprano. Would you make that analogy for us?
I'm a big fan of the Sopranos TV show, and I hadn't really thought about this until I was in Iraq. I'd not been in Baghdad previously. And when I got to Iraq, and you start going around Saddam Hussein's old palaces, looking at his approach, looking at his capabilities, it really struck me that this guy was not so much a kind of Middle Eastern version of Hitler or something, or a modern sort of Soviet Stalin type, that more he was Tony Soprano. This was a thugocracy. I think the way he ran the country, his values, his aesthetics, and his administrative abilities all were much more like that of a mob boss. And the Ba'athist Party, basically, was like his mafia family. This is not to excuse him at all. I think he was a thoroughly evil guy, and you see this talking to Iraqis constantly, the stories that are just coming out now. People who for years had told their neighbors, oh, my son died in the Iran-Iraq war, are now confessing, no, my son was executed, or now finding out that their son was executed. Their son disappeared in 1986 or something. And now, as the papers are being gone through, the documentary evidence, they're finding out that their son was indeed executed. So even Iraqis are now just finding out the depth of evil. But it was not this Soviet-style or Stalinist evil, was my impression. It was much more a small-minded, grasping, greedy, mafia-style evil. And this seems facetious to talk about it, but I don't think it is. The aesthetics of the place, you look at his palaces, and they're kind of cheesy. There's a lot of money thrown in it, but it's not very nice. It's kind of
gaudy, you know, right?
Soldiers would talk about this.
Uh-huh.
Just sort of, they'd say this is kind of chintzy. This, you know, there'd be these a lot of gold paint and marble thrown around, but not particularly to any pleasing effect. And the big heads, I hadn't known this. There are two palaces, two of his more modern palaces, in downtown Baghdad, have big Saddam heads on them. One has four of Saddam's heads, probably 15 foot tall. And actually, the soldiers, in their humor, refer to it as the Forehead Palace, which now starts sounding like Forehead. But they call it the Forehead Palace. And then where ORHA, the American Civil Occupation Administration, is referred to as the Big Head Palace, because it even has more big heads on it. But this was a guy, the only way he could really celebrate himself and his regime was by making things bigger. So you've got these huge cross swords downtown, probably 100 feet tall, and big, dumb stuff. But as it's a shame, given the beautiful history of Arab architecture, the stuff that he built.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Ricks, and he's just spent 3 weeks in Baghdad. He returned about a week ago. He covers the military for The Washington Post. So are the troops who are now charged with peacekeeping actually trained for that?
Yes and no. They contend they are. The Army contends they are. And I think from the company level, captains, sergeants, and privates, yeah, they are trained for what they're doing, and they're doing a very good job of it. They are bringing a lot of energy and courage and skills to the job of peacekeeping. I did come away with some questions about the institutional Army, how the generals think about peacekeeping, how they approached it. It's an opinion, it's not a fact, but my opinion, having looked at the U.S. peacekeeping in Iraq, is that the Army didn't bring to the peacekeeping mission the same sort of boldness and audacity and decisiveness that it brought to the war. That war plan was a brilliant war plan, executed with great audacity and decisiveness, and they took Baghdad in 21 days. Very impressive. That's a campaign that will be studied for years to come. And they took real risk in how they approached it. I don't see that kind of audacity and risk-taking in the peacekeeping, partly because of the way the Army thinks about peacekeeping. The Army decided about 10 years ago, when it first started taking on peacekeeping missions in Bosnia and Haiti and so on, that peacekeeping is what they called a lesser-included case. And that means if you can fight, if you're trained for high-intensity combat, then you can do things like peacekeeping because they're slower, easier, and rather smaller. I don't think that's the case. It may be true for the individual soldier who needs those combat skills, who needs to be able to escalate quickly to protect himself and his unit and to execute his mission. But I think it's different at the large unit level. One example. The U.S. Army is great at communicating with itself, which is what you need when you're fighting a war. You need to be able to move information quickly, up and down and across units to deal with a threat and to attack. The U.S. military is not very good at communicating outside itself. And for peacekeeping, unlike war fighting, you really need to communicate outside yourself. You need to plug into a society. You need to be talking constantly to locals, to in Baghdad, to local police, to foreign reporters, to Iraqi reporters, to local clerics, to school teachers. And the U.S. Army doesn't do that very well. Ask for a phone number in Baghdad, and it's funny. Everybody in Baghdad, of consequence, has a Thuraya satellite phone. That's how that society operates. The U.S. military doesn't have very many. It probably has 10 Thuraya telephones inside Iraq. They don't have as best I could tell, they don't have the list of Thuraya phone numbers, which is how you would plug into Iraqi elites. One day, my translator turned to me and said, "Why isn't there a hotline in Baghdad so that if my neighbor sees somebody running down the street with rocket-propelled grenades, which is not a weapon of self-defense, it's a weapon of attack that you'd use to attack the U.S. military, why isn't there a hotline that we can call?"
Like a 911 equivalent to get to the Army.
Yeah. I mean, and when I asked generals about this, they'd say, "Oh, that's a good idea." Well, fellas, it's a little bit late to be having good ideas. I mean, that's not the way they go in and fight wars. They go in having thought through these things. And the really striking thing to me was the 1st Armored Division, the army unit sent in to replace the 3rd Infantry Division and become the core of U.S. peacekeeping in Baghdad, did not do a mission rehearsal exercise for peacekeeping. And a mission rehearsal exercise is key to the Army saying, "We're ready to go and execute a mission." I don't think they would send a unit into combat that had not done such a mission rehearsal exercise. But the 1st Armored Division did not have a peacekeeping exercise before it went into Baghdad.
When you walk through the streets of Baghdad, is there much of a visible presence of U.S. soldiers?
When I first arrived in Baghdad in early May, there was not. The 3rd Infantry Division, which took Baghdad in early April, kind of hunkered down and went into a war-fighting stance, even in Baghdad, which was proper. They'd fought their way into Baghdad. That they didn't transition to peacekeeping. And this is not my critique. This is something I heard frequently from soldiers and officers in the 1st Armored Division, their replacement unit. And so for about a month there in Baghdad, the U.S. Army was there but wasn't really visible. And if you talk to people who were there in Baghdad during that period in late April, it was then when a lot of the looting occurred. And I think also when a lot of the sabotage by members of the old regime occurred, when they realized that the army was there but wasn't going to stop them. And so a lot of the damage to the infrastructure, to electricity, to trains, and so on, occurred, I was told, in late April when they realized the 3rd Infantry Division was going to stay inside its compounds and behind its walls and not come out and stop them. By late May, the situation was very different. In late May, the 1st Armored Division took over brigade by brigade, sector by sector, across Baghdad with the intent of really getting a lot of patrols out and a lot of presence out. And that really did occur in late May, and I think it notably changed the security situation in Baghdad. I was out on a foot patrol with a unit from the 1st Armored Division one afternoon in southeastern Baghdad, and it was a very typical patrol. They were walking along, and a guy came up and said, "We have two Alibabas," which is how Baghdadis refer to looters. "We have two Alibabas. Will you come and get them?" So they went around the corner. Sure enough, they were there. These were looters. They'd been stopped, caught, and beaten by the people in the neighborhood. And the patrol was wondering what to do with them, and suddenly around a corner came a bunch of MPs in two Humvees from the Illinois Army National Guard. And the foot patrol I was with was really pleased. "Oh, good, we can get rid of these two looters we've just detained." And so off we went on our foot patrol, continuing it, and ran into another foot patrol, this one from the 3rd Infantry Division. So in this one little neighborhood, three different U.S. patrols are going on, also U.S. helicopters clattering overhead. So the presence of the U.S. Army really sharply increased in late May in Baghdad, and I think that really did improve the security situation.
Now, we're talking about the U.S. military's new role as peacekeepers in Iraq. You said that there's a fair number of U.S. military on the streets now, that they're a visible presence. What about the old Iraqi police? Do you see any of them around? And how many of them have actually stayed in their function as police officers?
When I first got to Baghdad in early May, you didn't see any of them. And I actually went to a meeting at which they were trying to talk to their commanders to get them to get Iraqi police back out on the streets. And by the time I left, actually, you were seeing quite a lot of them, frequently with American MPs behind them, literally almost pushing them along. You'd see an Iraqi police car with a U.S. Humvee behind it, pushing it, sort of. There are some problems with the Iraqi police, which is a lot of them, I think, were seen as the rather thuggish enforcers of the regime. And so there's a lot of public distrust of them, and they're very conscious of that. And so the Americans are kind of a guarantor in both directions, not only that the Iraqi police will go out and enforce the law, but also the Americans are kind of protecting the Iraqi police from the people of Baghdad who distrust them and sometimes violently hate them.
Police always have to make tough judgment calls about who is a potential danger and who is just like making a mistake. Were you with the U.S. soldiers when they had to make a difficult judgment call about whether to fire on somebody, about whether this was a major crime or a hostile act that was underway, or just, you know, just something that they were misinterpreting?
It's actually something that I find hugely impressive about U.S. troops. Remember, most of the troops out there are guys 19 to 22 years old, generally who have maybe 2-3 years in the military. Some of them are just a couple of months out of boot camp, and they're constantly, every one of them, making these very tough decisions. One that really struck me was I was watching a private named Sean Jones, who told me he had graduated from boot camp on Valentine's Day, say 3 months ago. And he was over in Sector 37 North. It's a neighborhood in West Baghdad that's considered hostile by the U.S. military. And an Iraqi who was drunk came up and started yelling at him. And Jones first motioned him away with his hand. "Back off," he said. And the guy kept on coming at him very aggressively, only a couple of feet away. Jones took a half a step back and raised his weapon up to the ready position, not pointing it directly at the guy, still looking over the weapon rather than along sighting over its barrel, maintaining eye contact over the weapon, and at that point the guy backed off. And I was talking to his platoon sergeant about it, and he said, "That's very impressive, a private doing that kind of measured escalation, but still escalation. It's escalation at the smallest possible level, which is one human being with another human being."
Mm-hmm.
They constantly have to deal with that. One day I was at a gate talking to some soldiers, and they said earlier today, a kid came up and pointed a Colt 45 weapon. It looked like a Colt 45 pistol. It turned out later to have been an air pistol. And the soldiers dropped to the ground and yelled at the kid to drop it, but they were ready to shoot if the kid started shooting at them. And it turned out later he was a local kid who wanted to play soldier. And they were very pleased with themselves that they hadn't fired at him. They were actually very angry with the kid and took him to his mother and said, "You know, we nearly shot at this kid. You got to tell this kid to not point weapons at American troops." Every soldier is constantly dealing with that. The other thing that worries them a lot when they're out of patrol is people will come up with tips, and they're very wary of the tip that sounds too good, like, "Oh, there are some Saddam's fedayeen around the corner with a lot of weapons." They're worried about being led into ambushes. And so there's that constantly, "Oh, that's good, this guy sounds friendly, but is he actually leading us into something?" And these are kids, usually a year or two out of high school, who are making these decisions and being judged by the world media every day about it.
What are the living conditions like for the U.S. troops in Baghdad now?
They vary enormously, the living conditions. Some of the 3rd ID guys who had been there a while actually had surprisingly nice conditions. They were in some of the palaces downtown that still had electricity and running water. The conditions of U.S. troops out at the airport were shockingly bad, especially for an army that's been present there for a couple of months. Troops out there were sleeping really in crowded conditions, no air conditioning, no running water, no electricity. I was surprised at how bad it was. It didn't seem to me that it was necessary. Now, part of the problem was they had suddenly doubled the number of U.S. troops in the area because they kept the 3rd Infantry Division there and added in the 1st Armored Division. Even so, it seemed to me that there probably would have been ways of giving the troops better conditions. At the same time, part of keeping the morale steady over a long mission of several months' duration is to steadily improve the conditions of troops. So that may be part of the U.S. Army's calculation. if the troops come in and they have everything, then they kind of expect more. If they come in and have nothing, then they're very pleased by each addition, as you give them electricity, air conditioning, and so on. And they're going to need air conditioning. I was astonished at how hot it was in May, temperatures of 110, 115. And I'm told that in July and August, it'll get up to 125 in Baghdad.
You were traveling with Anthony Shadid, who writes for The Washington Post and was in Baghdad during the war. You decided to divide up, and one of you traveled with the U.S. troops, and the other stayed behind and talked to the people who had been interacting with the troops. And your goal was to get the perceptions, the military perceptions and the civilian perceptions, about how the occupation is going.
Well, the situation was this. I said we have a unique opportunity here. We have two Washington Post reporters, Anthony Shadid, who speaks Arabic fluently, and me. I speak military fluently.
Oh, got it. So, sure.
Why don't we go out on one patrol, and I'll be with the troops, and Anthony will trail along in our wake. And then at the end of the patrol, we'll compare notes. And it was really astonishing. We did this, actually, a couple of Sundays ago. Again, it was over in Sector 37 North, which I'd picked because it was considered a hostile neighborhood by U.S. military intelligence. And actually, a soldier had been killed there a few days before. And so we walk along on the patrol, and the soldiers on the patrol were telling me generally, you know, how much they liked the neighborhood. People came up and liked them. Their assessment was somewhere between 50 and 70% of the residents appreciated their presence and liked having them there and understood that they were just there to help out, and that then the U.S. would go home when their help was no longer needed. And Anthony Shadid, the other Post reporter, traveled along behind and actually came up to me a couple of times during the patrol and said, "You won't believe how different the perceptions are." Even as one soldier was telling me, "People here love us." Shadid was interviewing a local who said, "When I see the American patrols go by, it's like they're walking on my heart. It's crushing." And Shadid's very sensitive to this, the loaded sense of the term occupation. He said, "To the U.S., occupation is actually a fairly benign term." And we talked about how in the U.S. culture, occupation brings back memories of, you know, post-war Germany, post-war Japan, democracy growing, you know, even cheesy stuff like the Sayonara song, which was a hit that came out of Japan at the time of occupation. To the average Iraqi, occupation is a loaded term that evokes the Israeli situation with Palestinians. And they really are coming to identify with that. A lot of those people in the neighborhood would say, "Oh, we're being occupied just like Israel is. And the Americans are here for our oil. They're not here to help us." And there really was a sense that this was just ships passing in the night. The American soldiers' perception of what they were doing there and the local Baghdadi perception of what the American soldiers were doing there was vastly different.
Did you tell any of the soldiers or any of their leaders about the general population's perceptions about the military and the occupation?
We did, and it really turned on one point in the patrol. The soldiers were very eager to take us to a school. They really were trying to help. It's a school for autistic children, and apparently the only such school in all of Iraq. And the company, Bravo Company, of this one battalion had adopted this school and really was looking out to protect it and help it. And it had been subject to some shooting and some attempted looting. And when we got there, I was very impressed by how the soldiers were very sensitive to the issues with autistic children. All the soldiers were wearing sunglasses and carrying weapons, obviously. And they all took off their sunglasses outside and then stacked their weapons, left a couple of soldiers there to guard them, and then went inside and were very gentle with the children, got down on their knees, talked to them, tried to evoke responses. One soldier in particular made sure he went to every classroom. There are certain kids he's come to know and talk to. And it was a moving moment to see these young soldiers dealing with these kids. And Anthony Shadid stayed outside and talked to some of the neighbors. And the neighbors were telling Anthony, "Oh, we think the soldiers are going in there and having sex with the women who run the school."
Whoa.
And just an astonishingly different perception. And at the end of the patrol, it was quite hot. We found a shady spot in the corner of where the U.S. troops were basing out of, and sat around and had some cold sodas and talked. And Anthony told them of this, and you could just see them visibly sag. The lieutenant, who was the platoon leader, said, "Oh, I just hate hearing that," because he'd been so proud of what they'd been doing with the school. And to have that Iraqi perception just, first of all, stunned him and clearly really bothered him, and I think the soldiers didn't know quite what to make of it.
What do you make of it, about this gap of perceptions and what it says about the larger mission and its ability to succeed?
I came away with a couple of thoughts. First, I think the U.S. military is going to be there for a while. The army is going to be there for a while. And the sooner the U.S. government sort of fesses up to that, probably the better. My second thought was, they're not going to love us. They're not going to like us. They're not going to welcome this presence, the Iraqis. Even those people who felt it was necessary for security or to prevent a civil war between Sunnis and Shiites really are not pleased to have it there. They find it kind of humiliating. Especially men in their 20s and 30s really seem to kind of bristle around U.S. troops. And I think the U.S. public and the U.S. military should probably face the fact that we're not going to be welcome there, despite probably needing to be there for a while.
How's the morale of the soldiers? Could you tell?
Kind of all over the place. The 3rd Infantry Division has a real morale issue, I think. You know, these are guys, some of them, who deployed out to Kuwait last November, set several months preparing for war or trained for war. They weren't just sitting. They were working hard to prepare for it. Then fought a war that, in retrospect, may seem easy, but was not an easy war. It was a hard-fought campaign. And then sat in Baghdad, not really peacekeeping, but in a combat stance for a couple of months, and thought they'd be going home when the 1st Armored Division came in. And instead, the 2nd Brigade of the 3rd Infantry Division, when I was there, was shifted west out to the town of Fallujah, about 50 miles west of Baghdad, where there's a lot of fighting still going on. And so these guys are kind of wondering, are they ever going to go home? And I think they probably will, but probably not for a couple of months. 1st Armored Division, I thought, was in better shape morale-wise. They came in knowing they were doing a peacekeeping mission, and were out to execute it, and could see themselves having an effect pretty quickly on security in Baghdad. My two measures were the amount of automatic weapons fire I heard at night outside my hotel, which went from early May quite a lot to, by the time I left in early June, very little. And also adolescent girls in the streets. When I first got there, you did not see adolescent girls in the streets. Their families were just afraid to have them out because of fear of kidnapping and rape. And by the time I left, you actually saw quite a few, especially in middle-class neighborhoods, quite a few adolescent girls out on the streets, always with somebody else, with a parent or with an older brother, but still present. And so clearly Baghdadis felt the security was better. And I think the 1st Armored Division guys kind of could take some pride in saying that we actually have helped this place become more normal, more secure.
The U.S. military is undergoing a major restructuring and realignment of forces around the world. What are the reasons for this major realignment?
Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, has made the assessment that the U.S. military, especially the army, hasn't changed enough in response to the end of the Cold War. And he's asking a lot of tough questions, which, for example, is why do we still have so many troops in Germany? Germany is not a frontline nation. It no longer has a Warsaw Pact organization facing it across the East German border. Why do we have those troops there? Why not move them somewhere else? And so they've been looking at things like, how about moving troops out to the new NATO countries, Poland, Hungary? How about having troops in Central Asia? Do you want to have troops based there permanently with that large structure of Defense Department schools and PXs and hospitals? Or do you want to rotate troops out for 6 months at a time? So he's asking a lot of questions and forcing a lot of change.
And does he have any opponents in this change?
Large numbers of opponents, I'd say from two basic schools. One is a large part of the U.S. military, and especially the Army, is very skeptical of Donald Rumsfeld at this point, despite the fact that he's overseen the successful execution of two wars in 2 years. They kind of see him as being a Robert McNamara-like figure, the sort of corporate wise guy who comes in and doesn't understand how they do things or why they do things, but just demands change. There's also a minority in the military that's skeptical of Rumsfeld because while they agree with some of the changes that he's trying to make, they think he doesn't understand the fundamental problems. For example, the Army is really going to be strapped by peacekeeping in Iraq at the same time that it continues to have troops in Afghanistan, faces a hostile North Korea, and is being told by Rumsfeld to deal with all those missions and to change itself radically. And they feel that, A, they probably need more money if they're going to do that, and B, they almost certainly need more troops if they're going to do that.
In the meantime, Donald Rumsfeld is replacing some of the people at the top of the military. Who has he recently replaced?
You've got a lot of changes coming, especially in the Army. In a very unusual move, he fired the Army Secretary Tom White a couple of months ago, and then moved in the Air Force Secretary, a guy named James Roach, with an unusual background. He was a career Navy officer, and then he was a Democratic staffer on Capitol Hill, and then was a defense industry executive, and then was head of the Air Force, the Secretary of the Air Force. So this is not somebody with an Army background, and clearly, though, has a background that Rumsfeld liked, and Rumsfeld has put him on top of the Army with the message to change the Army. The other big change coming in the Army is, this week, General Eric Shinseki, the Chief of Staff of the Army, retires. And unusually, they don't have a replacement on hand. Tommy Franks, the U.S. commander for Afghanistan and Iraq, was offered the job, and I am told turned it down. And they're looking around, Rumsfeld's people are looking around. There's not a lot of other senior Army officers they like. They originally had wanted the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, Jack Keane, a really widely admired officer, to take the job, but for personal reasons he feels he can't, and he wants to retire. So they're looking around, and they haven't come up with any other replacements. This is a really startling situation, that here you have the U.S. Army, having just fought a war, still engaged in a major mission in Iraq, and it has a new civilian service secretary coming in with no Army background, and they don't even have a general to lead the Army right now.
Is Donald Rumsfeld a particularly powerful Secretary of Defense?
I think he's an astonishingly powerful Secretary of Defense, probably the most powerful secretary ever. Both within the Pentagon and with his influence over how the military does what it does, and outside the Pentagon and things like foreign policy. As a defense secretary, he was unusually involved in the formulation of the war plan for Iraq and personnel choices, which is really what drives the military, promotion and personnel picks. He's very involved personally reviewing selections of top officers, interviewing them, and sometimes turning them down, saying this guy just doesn't have the qualities that I'm looking for. And outside the Pentagon, I mean, arguably, he's had more influence over U.S. foreign policy than Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, has had in recent weeks and months. And that's kind of astonishing because Powell came in the only superstar in the cabinet and I think probably has been eclipsed by Rumsfeld.
Of course, Powell was the career military guy. Rumsfeld is the civilian.
Yeah, and it's kind of odd because Powell does still have a lot of connections to the military. I remember one officer telling me that when you go into a cabinet meeting, he said, you just naturally gravitate towards Powell because he knows the lingo, he knows the talk in a way that Rumsfeld and his people don't. Nonetheless, Powell has really kept out of military affairs and has not interfered with the Pentagon, at least publicly, while Rumsfeld has just run all over the air foreign policy, making pronouncements, changes, sort of unilaterally laying down policy in certain areas.
How are things between Rumsfeld and Powell right now?
I don't know. You know, their public line is, we get along, we see each other all the time. I just don't buy it. It's just the body language and what you hear from subordinates is a real friction and a very different view of the world and of what the U.S. military and what the U.S. government should be doing right now. I do think they fundamentally agree, though, on the goal, which is to fight a global war on terrorism in a way that makes the United States more secure than it was on September 11, 2001. But I think there's fundamental disagreement about how to get there.
You know, from the outside, it's so hard to tell how much disagreement there is, because Powell, who resisted the war in Iraq, when he addressed the UN, seemed to kind of change gears and to get behind it. And I think a lot of people are confused, like, what changed in his mind?
Well, you mentioned that Powell is a career military guy, and the thing to remember about him is he is a good soldier in the sense of duty and loyalty. And more than being just a good soldier, he's a good infantryman. And in the infantry, more than any other part of the military, you really need to make sure you're tied in on your flanks, that you don't get way ahead of the people on your left and right, the units on your left and right. Because if you do, you're going to end up getting soldiers killed. You're going to be too exposed in your flanks, or the people on your flanks are going to think you're the enemy out in front of them and shoot you. So Powell really does place a premium on being tied in on his flanks. I remember early in the administration, he got in some sort of problem on Korea policy and said some things that seemed to get him out ahead of the administration. And he told reporters a couple of days later, I was wrong, I wasn't tied in on my flanks. And I explained to our diplomatic reporters how significant a statement that was, which is his point was, even if I was right, I was wrong because I got out ahead of things. So Powell really, more than most people, I think, does value being tied in and being supported and being part of the team. And I think we'll probably go to his grave keeping a lot of his differences with Donald Rumsfeld private.
The U.S. won the war in Iraq pretty swiftly, but now it's a question of what happens with the peace, and the peace hasn't been all that peaceful. And there's a lot of troops that will have to be stationed in Iraq for a comparatively long time to make that transition to a new Iraqi government. In the meantime, the Bush administration is talking in such a way as to lead many people to believe that they might make a similar move in Iran, or possibly in Syria, or who knows, maybe North Korea. I'm wondering what you're hearing from, like, your military sources about how the military would feel about taking on another country.
The U.S. military feels pretty strained right now, especially the Army. This is always a problem for the Army, is that we have these 3 or 4 week wars in places like Kosovo or Afghanistan or Iraq, and everybody high-fives each other and goes home, except for the Army. The Navy, the Air Force, the Marines all leave, although the Marines are still in southern Iraq right now doing peacekeeping. They expect to get out pretty soon. The Army stays. For the Army, these small modern wars are kind of the Roach Motels wars. They check in and they don't check out. One phrase you use, the war is over, I think there's a good part of Iraq isn't persuaded of that, especially this area west of Baghdad, from Fallujah up to Tikrit, which is kind of the Sunni heartland. These are people for whom the U.S. is in no way or form a liberator. All the U.S. is doing is knocking these people out of positions of power, out of really the top of the thugocracy, the pyramid of power in Iraq. And that's where you're seeing a lot of fighting still going on, and U.S. troops dying one or two every couple of days. I think so. There's a small-scale war still going out in that crescent west and northwest of Baghdad. So the notion of taking on any other big jobs, I think, is quite frightening to the military and especially to the Army. I don't think Syria is likely. The word on the ground that I got from intelligence officers in Iraq was that Syria really had shaped up after the U.S. threats right at the end of the war. And also, even Iran, they had said, is really on its best behavior right now inside Iraq. That, yes, there is an Iranian presence, they monitor U.S. operations, but it's kind of seen as a legitimate interest of a neighboring country. The big worry in the U.S. military is North Korea. The United States nearly went to war with North Korea in the mid-1990s, and that was with an administration that did not have a policy of preemption. Now you have an administration that does have that policy, and North Korea is acting friskier and more provocative than they did back then. So it seems to me that's the recipe for hostilities to break out that really worries the U.S. military right now.
So just one more thing. You know, you reported from Baghdad for 3 weeks. What was the experience like for you?
I loved it. It was a little bit scary. You had to be careful. One of the rules we had was to get back to the hotel room by dark and not go out after dark because of AK-47 fire, especially when I was first there. But just you'd walk out of your hotel room in the morning or you'd go out driving, and there's just news stories all over the place. It's what the military would call a lucrative environment. You'd go out with one story in mind, report it, and trip across two others. And it was fun reporting, and for a Washington reporter, it was such a relief to have everybody on the record. I look at my notebooks, and every single soldier I talked to, every single Iraqi I talked to, everything's on the record. So while it was a little bit scary and difficult at times, I think a very difficult reporting environment, it also, as a reporter, was just an astonishingly enjoyable experience to keep on finding news stories and be able to report them.
Well, Tom Ricks, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Ricks covers the military for The Washington Post.